From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Today's the beginning of the new year for the original peoples of the world in which we seek equality and justice.
Evo Morales is sworn in as Bolivia's first indigenous president. He promised to bring justice to the country's Indian majority and once again pledged to nationalize Bolivia's vast natural gas reserves. We'll get the latest. Then we look at Haiti, which is preparing for its upcoming elections. We'll speak with independent Canadian journalist Anthony Fenton about the National Endowment for Democracy, the U.S.-funded group that is pouring millions of dollars into trying to influence Haiti's political future.
If democracy were to take root in Haiti, what would that say about U.S. democracy? And there's always a fear of democracy spreading throughout the hemisphere to other places. So it's very important that the U.S. vision for Haiti and for the world is implemented with strong force. And
all that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Bolivia, the country's first ever indigenous president, Evo Morales, was sworn in Sunday. Morales called his election, quote, the end of the colonial and neoliberal era. On Sunday, he spoke before the Bolivian Congress.
Estamos acá para decir, basta la resistencia de 500 años, a la toma del poder para 500 años.
Morales told the Congress, quote, the 500 years of Indian resistance have not been in vain. From 500 years of resistance, we pass to another 500 years of power, he said. We'll go to Bolivia for a report in a few minutes. The ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee has asked 20 telephone and internet companies whether they've allowed the federal government to eavesdrop on their customers' communications. Congressmember John Conyers of Michigan sent the letters to Microsoft, AT&T, Bell South, Verizon, Earthlink, Google, and a dozen other companies. Telecom experts say the National Security Agency may have gotten permission from phone companies to gain access to so-called switches, high-powered computers into which phone traffic flows and is redirected. Last month, President Bush admitted he ordered the NSA to conduct domestic spy operations without getting legally required court warrants. Meanwhile, President Bush is heading to Kansas today to launch a week-long series of speeches defending the domestic spying. He plans to visit the NSA headquarters in Maryland on Wednesday. In news from the occupied territories, the Washington Post is reporting the United States has quietly funneled about $2 million into projects organized by the Palestinian Authority ahead of Wednesday's parliamentary elections. According to the Post, the Bush administration is spending the foreign aid money in an effort to help the Palestinian Authority's Fatah party defeat Hamas. U.S. has publicly claimed it promotes democracy in the region, but it has warned it'll not recognize any Palestinian government in which Hamas participates. In recent weeks, the U.S. has clandestinely funded street cleaning campaigns, the distribution of free food and water at border crossings, the donation of computers to community centers, and the sponsoring of a national youth soccer tournament. The money has also been used to take out advertisements promoting the public service work of the Palestinian Authority. According to the Washington Post, the United States is on track to spend more on these projects than any Palestinian party will spend during the election campaign. Another mining tragedy has hit the state of West Virginia. The bodies of two miners were found Saturday night following a fire inside a mine in the town of Alma. The men died after the mine's conveyor belt caught fire. Their deaths come just weeks after 12 miners died in Sago, West Virginia. More miners have already died in the state in 2006 than in any year over the past decade. The Alma mine, which is owned by a subsidiary of Massey Energy, had been cited at least 12 times for violations involving fire equipment since June. According to the Charleston Gazette, the mining deaths may have occurred because of a controversial new rule put in place by the Bush administration that allowed mines to use the conveyor belt area as a main source of oxygen for underground workers. The mining industry had long sought the rule change, but mining experts feared it would lead to an increase in fires. The editorial page of the New York Times came out today in opposition to Samuel Alito's confirmation to the Supreme Court. The paper's editors warn, quote, he has a radically broad view of the president's power and a radically narrow view of Congress's power. He's long argued that the Constitution does not protect abortion rights. He wants to reduce the rights and liberties of ordinary Americans and has a history of tilting the scales of justice against the little guy. Again, those are the words of the New York Times editorial. In news on Hurricane Katrina, 3,200 people are officially still unaccounted for, according to the Find Family National Call Center. Louisiana's medical examiner has announced plans to ask state and parish officials to recheck about 400 homes in badly flooded neighborhoods to look for bodies. The official death toll from the storm stands at just over 1,300. On Friday, Michael Fortier was released after serving less than 11 years in federal prison for his connection to the 1995 bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City that killed 168 people and injured more than 400. The bombing was the deadliest domestic terrorist attack in U.S. history. Fortier knew about the bombing plan in advance and admitted to transporting stolen weapons to help finance the blast. Fortier received a reduced sentence in part because he agreed to testify against Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. The government has said little about Fortier's release, though it's believed he and his family will be put in the witness protection program. Meanwhile, on the same day that Fortier was released, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and FBI Director Robert Mueller announced the indictments of 11 people accused of carrying out a series of arsons in the name of Earth and Animal Liberation Fronts. The indictments listed 65 charges, including arson, sabotage, and conspiracy in attacks against government facilities, research centers, and private businesses. Although none of the arsons caused any deaths, at least one of the indicted activists, Daniel McGowan, is facing life in prison. Last year, federal investigators told a Senate committee that environmental and animal groups like ELF and ALF represent the nation's leading domestic terror threat. The Southern Poverty Law Center, however, recently criticized the federal government for underestimating the threat posed by violent right-wing organizations. According to the center, the radical right has plotted to carry out at least 60 terrorist plots inside the U.S. since the Oklahoma City bombing. This includes plans to bomb or burn government buildings, mosques, synagogues, and abortion clinics, plans to assassinate government officials and civil rights leaders, and efforts to amass chemical and biological weapons arsenals. In news from the United Nations, the Pakistani human rights advocate Mukhtar Mai was denied a chance to speak at the United Nations on Friday after protests from the Pakistani government. According to the New York Times, she'd been scheduled to make an appearance at an event called An Interview with Mukhtar Mai, the Bravest Woman on Earth. In 2002, a Pakistani village council ordered Mai to be gang-raped for the supposed misconduct of her brother. After surviving the rape, Mai successfully sued her rapists in court. She's since become a leading advocate for women's rights in Pakistan. In Haiti, murder charges have been dropped against jailed Catholic priest Gerard Jean-Just, but he remains jailed on two new lesser charges, illegal weapons possession and criminal conspiracy. Supporters of Jean-Just have argued the priest is a political prisoner being detained because of his close ties to the ousted president Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Jean-Just wanted to run in next month's presidential election, but was barred from doing so because he was behind bars. Amnesty International has declared him a prisoner of conscience. A military jury has convicted an army interrogator of negligent homicide for his role in the death of an Iraqi general. The interrogator, Chief Warrant Officer Louis Welshoffer, Jr., killed the Iraqi man by putting a sleeping bag over the general's head, wrapping him in electrical cords, sitting on his chest, and covering his mouth. He faced up to 3 years in prison. Had Welshoffer been convicted of murder, he would have been sentenced to life in prison. Attorneys for Welshoffer said he'd been given permission to use harsh techniques during interrogations. In one email, Captain William Ponce wrote, quote, "The gloves are coming off, gentlemen. We want these individuals broken. Casualties are mounting." The interrogator's attorneys also question why no one else was charged in the general's death. The general was severely beaten 2 days before his death by a group of Iraqis reportedly being paid by the CIA. In news on Iraq, former workers at Halliburton have accused the company of exposing troops and civilians at a U.S. military base in Iraq to contaminated water. One Halliburton official admitted in an internal memo from July that the level of contamination was twice the normal contamination of untreated water from the Euphrates River. Former Pentagon analyst Larry Franklin has been sentenced to 12 years in jail for passing secret information on Iran to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APEC, and to an Israeli diplomat. Here in New York City, the country's largest transit union rejected a new contract Friday by a margin of only 7 votes. Over 22,000 workers cast ballots. The vote came just weeks after the transit workers staged a 3-day strike, shutting down New York's subway and bus system. Younger workers widely opposed part of the contract that required workers to pay 1.5% more in health care payments. And in Mali, thousands are gathering this week in the capital city for the first ever World Social Forum in Africa. This year, the forum is holding 3 sessions in Mali, Venezuela, and Pakistan. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Bolivia, the country's first ever indigenous president, Evo Morales, was sworn in Sunday. He focused his nearly 2-hour inaugural address on bringing justice to Bolivia's indigenous majority. Morales spoke of the years of discrimination against Indians and compared Bolivia to apartheid-era South Africa. He also reaffirmed his pledge to nationalize the country's vast natural gas reserves and asked wealthy nations to write off Bolivia's $3.4 billion in foreign debt. Bolivia is the poorest country in South America, but has the second largest reserves of natural gas on the continent. The 46-year-old Morales won the presidency in December with more popular support than any Bolivian president in decades. He's the latest in a string of left-leaning leaders to assume power in South America in what many see as a backlash against U.S.-backed free market policies. Bolivia has had 5 presidents in 4 years. Morales' rise to power began with his leadership of the Coca Growers Union and his high-profile opposition to the U.S.-funded eradication of the coca crop. He helped to lead the street demonstrations by Indian and union groups that toppled Bolivia's last 2 presidents. During his campaign, Morales said he would be the United States' quote, worst nightmare. He blasted the proposed free trade area of the Americas, saying the idea was a sure way to enslave Latin Americans to the interests of American big business. The U.S. has criticized Morales for his close ties to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and Cuban President Fidel Castro. But on Saturday, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Thomas Shannon met with Morales and reportedly expressed a desire to strengthen diplomatic relations with Bolivia. After meeting with Shannon, Morales told reporters, quote, relations between Bolivia and the United States are going to continue. An opinion poll released this weekend by the Bolivian firm Apoyo said that support for Morales stands at 74%, an unprecedented level in Bolivia's recent history. Morales broke into tears Sunday as he donned the presidential sash and medal. This is Evo Morales speaking at his inauguration.
We are here to say enough of the 500 years of Indian resistance. From 500 years of resistance, we pass to another 500 years in power.
On Saturday, a day before the official swearing-in ceremony, thousands of supporters came to the Indian ceremony that was held for Morales at Tiwanaku, a pre-Incan site that Indians believe confers strength on visitors. There, barefoot and dressed as a sun priest, he received a baton encrusted with gold, silver, and bronze that'll symbolize his Indian leadership. Here is some of what Morales said at that event.
Today is the beginning of the new year for the original peoples of the world in which we seek equality and justice. With the strength of the people, with the unity of the people, we will put an end to the colonial state and to the neoliberal model.
World leaders from 11 nations attended Evo Morales' inauguration on Sunday. They included Néstor Kirchner, the president of Argentina, Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva of Brazil, and the outgoing president of Chile, Ricardo Lagos. Also in attendance was Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who had this to say about Morales' victory.
If you want to know what is the path to hell, take the path of capitalism and the neoliberalism and of the so-called neoliberal globalization. So the triumph by Evo represents a strong thrust for change in South America, in the Americas, and the universe, because we are at a time of universal mutation.
We go now to Bolivia to speak with Sacha Llorente. He is the former head of the Human Rights Permanent National Assembly of Bolivia. He is also a current member of the National Council for the Constituents Assembly. After break, we'll go to Bolivia.
Boquita colorada, color de guinda, jamás yo había besado boca más linda. Boquita colorada, color de guinda, tu beso yo deseado, boquita linda. Ay, qué destino, vivir soñando, a mi morena linda, seguir amando.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We'll try to make contact in Bolivia, but right now we go to Binghamton, New York, to speak with James Petras, author and journalist, professor emeritus at SUNY Binghamton, author of the book Social Movements and State Power, Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, and Ecuador. James Petras, we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you on. Your response to the inauguration of Evo Morales and its significance in Bolivia and Latin America?
Well, obviously, it's aroused enormous expectations in Bolivia, some trepidation in Washington, and in Europe and the rest of Latin America. It's welcome to have a new government headed by the Indian president. I should remark for openers that Evo Morales has adopted a program that is clearly in line with welfare politics rather than a revolutionary or socialist politics. The expectation in the financial press is that he's going to press for increases in taxing the natural resource companies. He's going to look toward industrializing and processing the raw materials for value added, and they look toward him setting up some state companies to join as partners, the two existing or new investors. His trip certainly to Europe pacified investors a great deal in affirming his defense of existing investments and inviting new investments from European companies. So the image of a radical Indian leader, I think, is greatly exaggerated. He's what we might call a classical social democrat, reformer, who's looking more toward welfare reform, social programs to overcome the gross inequalities that exist in Bolivia. Now, there's a big problem with that because, especially among the Bolivian trade unions, the COB, the Miners Federation and some of the more radical community organizations, as in El Alto with 800,000 people. They're demanding immediate nationalization of petroleum and gas. Though Evo has spoken about nationalization, what I think he really is talking about, reading closer, is increasing the share, national share, of the revenues that are generated. I think that's where he's going. That's what he's announced. He said that he's going to defend private property. He said he's going to negotiate new contracts with the companies, which implies they're there. That as long as they pay their taxes, he said, and don't engage in chicanery, they have nothing to fear. So I think this is the real picture that you get. And, of course, a social democrat who is at least willing to pursue redistributive politics is seen in some right-wing circles as some kind of a radical threat. But I must insist, Undersecretary Shannon of the United States has announced that they're sending a delegation to discuss with Evo. The COCA issue that Evo has taken is we're not going to uproot the COCA plants, but we'll fight narcotics traffickers and those who convert COCA into cocaine. So there probably might be a point of negotiations there. He's already met with the ambassador on January 2nd, Greenlee, to Bolivia, and the meeting was pronounced cordial. So I think even in Washington is a recognition that Evo is not quite the firebrand. He's not going to be, quote, the nightmare that some newspapers have repeatedly said he stated. I think you have to discount a lot of the radical rhetoric that occasionally has been articulated. His vice president, who I think is less prone to that, has announced that their line of program is to produce an Andean capitalism, Andean Amazonic capitalism, which essentially means they're going to promote small and medium-sized businesses in addition to the large foreign-owned enterprises that exist in the country.
And Professor Petras, the issue of the coca leaf. Evo Morales this weekend prominently wearing the coca wreath.
Yeah, I think that Evo is not going to support eradication. He can't. That's one of his main mass bases. His line is very clear on that. He said he'll cooperate with the DEA, the United States, in fighting drug trafficking. He doesn't consider, and most people don't, the coca leaf is like a tea leaf. And I think he is going to explain this to the United States, and he's hoping that the U.S. understand there's a difference between coca farming and coca leaf production, coca tea, and cocaine, which is an obvious distinction, which hopefully Washington will recognize if it doesn't go off on the if it's not looking for a confrontation and wants to use so-called coca production, make it equivalent to cocaine. So I think there's a basis. Evo has laid out a very pragmatic basis for resolving that problem. It remains to be seen whether people like Greenlee, Shannon, are on top of this issue, or whether some of the ultras, the Cuban-American extremists, will intervene. My feeling is that Evo's trip to Europe gave the green light that this is not a radical government, this is not a revolutionary government, and I think his biggest problem, and I could be wrong on this, is going to be from many of the more organized and radical trade unionists and peasant organizers who are looking for him to fulfill his maximum program, his program of nationalizing gas and petroleum. And I think there's down the road, there's bound to be some conflicts. Now, one last point on that. He announced last night he's going to fight corruption, and he's going to eliminate the reserve funds of many of the functionaries, and that he's going to lower the top salaries in the public administration. So he's off, launched right off a campaign of austerity and anti-corruption, a moral campaign, and he hasn't spoken yet about any measures to nationalize in any meaningful sense gas and petroleum, and I doubt if he will.
And finally, just 30 seconds, but this picture now of Latin America, election after election of left-leaning leaders throughout Latin America.
I don't think they're left-leaning because for many reasons. Lula, for example, has opened the country up to more foreign investment. He's paid more on foreign debt than any previous supposedly conservative presidents. Certainly, Bachelet is not anything leaning to the left. She's led the arms race, free trade agreements, promoted enormous increases in arms spending. Chile leads per capita arms spending. I think you have to look at what the business press says, what they're saying in Washington. And when you get pronouncements from Condoleezza Rice and others saying that Chile is the U.S.'s best ally, and we're talking about the U.S. that has been aggressively pursuing bellicose policies, we have to moderate that perception that there's left-leaning. The Washington's shown an enormous capacity to tolerate rhetoric as long as it's not consequential. And the main problem for Washington continues to be Chavez because of his increasing nationalism and, of course, Cuba, and their attitude to the rest of Latin America is one of accommodation by necessity and also recognition that big property interests are not going to be affected. In fact, they're being promoted by some of these governments.
Professor James Petras, I want to thank you very much for being with us, author of Social Movements and State Power, Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, and Ecuador. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we turn now to Haiti, about to undergo an election next week, nearly 2 years after the overthrow of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti will be holding national elections February 7th. Former President René Préval, an Aristide ally, is leading in the polls. Meanwhile, a judge has dropped the most serious charges against jailed priest Gerard Jean-Just. Jean-Just was imprisoned in July over the murder of a journalist, Jacques Roche, killed while Jean-Just was here in Miami in the United States. After Jean-Just's arrest, Haitian officials prevented Lavalas, the political movement aligned with President Aristide, from registering Jean-Just as their presidential candidate on the grounds he was imprisoned. Although he's been cleared in Roche's murder, authorities say Jean-Just will remain in prison over weapons charges. Amnesty International calls him a prisoner of conscience. Calls for his release have intensified with the recent announcement he's been diagnosed with leukemia. Meanwhile, violence continues to affect Haiti's poorest areas. Last week, two Jordanian troops with the UN mission were killed in a gun battle in the poor neighborhood of Cité Soleil. Local residents later reported UN troops had shot at a hospital in the area. UN troops have stepped up armed raids of Cité Soleil amid pressure from business leaders and foreign officials. We want to continue our Haiti coverage leading up to the election by looking at the activities of a government-funded organization that's pouring millions of dollars into trying to influence Haiti's political future. The National Endowment for Democracy is one of a handful of state-funded organizations that have played a pivotal role in the internal politics of several Latin American and Caribbean countries in the service of the U.S. government. The NED operates with an annual budget of $80 million from the U.S. Congress and the State Department. In Venezuela, it's given money to several political opponents of President Hugo Chavez. With elections underway in Haiti, it's reportedly doing the same to groups linked to the country's tiny elite and former military. Last week, I interviewed Anthony Fenton about NED's activities in Haiti and across the Caribbean and Latin America. Fenton is an independent Canadian journalist and co-author of the book Canada and Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. He's interviewed several top governmental and non-governmental officials dealing with Haiti, as well as leading members of Haiti's business community. Last month, he helped expose an NED-funded journalist who was filing stories for the Associated Press from Haiti. The Associated Press subsequently terminated its relationship with her. We go now to an excerpt from that interview. Anthony Fenton was in a studio in Vancouver. I began by asking him to talk about the current situation in Haiti.
Well, indeed, obviously there's an ongoing military occupation there ever since the forced ouster of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in February of 2004 in a coup d'etat that was assisted and planned by the Canadian government along with the U.S. government and the French government. Of course, I'm speaking from Canada. Canada played an integral role in the overthrow of Aristide and has continued to play an integral role in the post-invasion occupation of Haiti. They're leading up to what are now the fourth scheduled period of elections. There have been several postponements. This is due in part, the original intention of the invasion, of course, was to subvert the young process of popular democracy that existed in Haiti prior to the coup. And, of course, if Aristide hadn't been overthrown, Haiti would have already carried out their democratic elections, their presidential elections. And, of course, the fear of the United States and of organizations like the National Endowment for Democracy and the State Department, of course, was that popular democracy would take root in Haiti under another Lavalas government. And they have set about to undermine the popular movement that existed in support of Jean-Bertrand Aristide and the Lavalas party. And we're seeing today the consolidation of the elite rule that they've long envisioned for Haiti ever since the fall of baby Doc Duvalier in the mid-'80s.
Anthony, can you just lay out what the National Endowment for Democracy is?
Well, yeah, they were formed in the early 1980s under the Reagan administration. Sensibly, they purport to promote pro-democracy organizations and democratic values across the world. Just last October, President Bush spoke at a National Endowment for Democracy gathering, reiterating the vision of Reagan as he set about to, as they say, promote democracy throughout the world. And they've been given various budgets by allocated by Congress every year. As you said at the onset, now their budget stands at $80 million a year. But they are, of course, just one organization among many that are linked to the U.S. Agency for International Development. As I said, the State Department, hundreds of millions of dollars now. In fact, more money is now being spent than ever before on what they call democracy promotion. Now, the historical record on the National Endowment for Democracy is very clear. When we look at the work of people like Philip Agee and William Robinson and William Bloom, Noam Chomsky and others, and most recently if we look at the work of attorney and independent journalist Eva Golinger, who exposed through Freedom of Information Act requests the role that the NED played in attempting to subvert democracy and the revolutionary process that's unfolding in Venezuela in 2002. The NED played a crucial role in fomenting the opposition to Hugo Chavez, and they did play a role in the attempted coup against him in April of 2002. And very, very much the same patterns we've seen develop in Haiti. On your show in 2004, you interviewed Max Blumenthal, who wrote an important article for Salon that outlined the role of the International Republican Institute. And when we talk about the NED, we can't talk about them without also talking about the International Republican Institute and the other affiliated organizations. There's a virtual labyrinth of these organizations that receive funding that's specifically earmarked for the undermining of any widespread social movements, any rudiments of popular democracy that should manifest either in Latin America or anywhere in the world. So again, this is sort of the premise of what the National Endowment for Democracy really does. And as we look at what they're doing in Haiti and how I was able to learn about what they're currently doing in Haiti came about through the process of a first documentary reporting trip to Haiti in September and October of 2005. Where we spoke to a number of NED grantees, Haitian organizations that receive funding from the National Endowment for Democracy. I returned to Canada and set about to conduct a series of interviews with NED, an NED program officer in particular, with IRI officials, with in-country officials who are managing several million dollars in U.S.-funded democracy promotion activities, as you said, also that are linked closely to the Haitian elite, to the opposition organizations such as the Group of 184, the Democratic Convergence. These are the organizations that agitated most strongly for the overthrow of Aristide and that were working with the NED and the IRI in the years preceding the 2004 coup.
The IRR being the International Republican Institute.
Yes, we know that. For example, just the other day I spoke to a woman who's a leader of an organization called COFEL. It's an umbrella organization of women political leaders. In the years before the coup against Aristide in 2004, the IRI would bus in or fly in groups of anywhere between 60 and 80 of these women. And, of course, they're busing in other men and other political figures in Haiti. But they would bus them into the Dominican Republic because in 1999, at the time, Ambassador Timothy Carney, he was a U.S. ambassador at the time. That's very important because Ambassador Carney is the current interim ambassador to Haiti, and he was also a member of the lobby, the think tank in Washington called the Haiti Democracy Project that played an integral role in fomenting this demonization campaign against Aristide. In any case, in 1999, the IRI was closed down. Their operations were shut down. They were forced to leave Haiti. And until the coup in 2004, the IRI did not have an in-country presence, so they're doing most of their work in the Dominican Republic with people like Stanley Lucas, who is well-known as a card-carrying Republican, Haitian-American, who was hired by the International Republican Institute during the first coup period against Aristide in the early 90s. And he's the one who sort of helped to build the political opposition from the Dominican Republic and enabled the coup to take place. But that process has just followed through since the coup. Well, of course, the International Republican Institute now has an in-country office in Haiti. And in that, through that office, they're able to penetrate all sectors of Haitian civil society in their attempt to undermine the popular movement. Now, I'd like to mention that in my interview, and this is a rare interview with an NED program officer, and this is the program officer in Washington who's responsible for Haiti currently, a woman named Fabiola Cordova. She took over in November as a program officer, and she revealed to me not only an extensive list of documents that show the NED's approved grants for 2005. These are in a sense, declassified, because these are documents that aren't supposed to be published until May of 2006, at least, according to another NED spokesperson. But what's clear in these documents is that the NED went from, for example, a $0 budget in Haiti in 2003 to a $540,000 budget in Haiti in 2005. What they've also done, and many Haitian people that I speak to have told me that Haiti is considered the laboratory for these sort of subversive activities on the part of the United States government. And in the context of this experimental process, they've hired for the first time an in-country program officer, as you mentioned. Regine Alexander, who is a stringer for the Associated Press and New York Times, was moonlighting as an NED program officer, and the Associated Press severed ties with her as a result. Now, Fabiola Cordova also told me that when she was in Haiti in 2002 working for one of the NED's affiliated organizations, the National Democratic Institute, she said a lot of lines were being drawn between Haiti and Venezuela, where although 70% of the population supported Aristide, there was a very fragmented opposition. The rest of the 30% was divided between 120 different opposition groups. So the objective of the IRI and the NED was to consolidate this opposition, to build a viable opposition, to somehow break the grip that the popular movement in Haiti had on the political environment there. And she said that Chavez, something very similar was happening in Venezuela. And, of course, in 2002, the coup d'etat happened there on the basis of this sort of analysis, the basis of this fear that the United States has of popular democracy and the need to subvert any attempts at consolidating popular rule and the implementing policies that are in the interests of the majority poor in places like Venezuela and Haiti.
We're talking to Anthony Fenton, independent author and journalist, who has exposed AP Stringer in Haiti, Regine Alexander, as also being on the payroll of the National Endowment for Democracy. And now talking about those parallels between Haiti and Venezuela. Of course, 2002, the attempted coup against Hugo Chavez. What is your understanding of the U.S. involvement in terms of the, you know, dollar amount in Venezuela putting money into the opposition?
Well, it's very interesting because since the activities of the NED have been so thoroughly exposed by the likes of Eva Golinger and Jeremy Bigwood through the Chavez Code, they're very concerned with their perception in the area. So what they're doing, in a way, they've continued to funnel large amounts of money into Venezuela, but they're doing it also by outsourcing, if you will. For example, they've given a grant to a Canadian think tank called the Canadian Foundation of the Americas. And through that, they're attempting to go through the back door, if you will, riding the perception of Canada as being a benign counterweight to the U.S. in the hemisphere in order to penetrate Venezuelan civil society. This is an important year, of course, not only in Venezuela, but throughout the hemisphere in the sense that there are many presidential elections taking place. Now, the NED program officer told me that Venezuela, Haiti, Ecuador, and Bolivia are the four top priority countries for the NED in 2006, looking ahead to 2006. And, of course, Cuba is a perennial top of that list. They're a special exception because the Department of State earmarks a certain amount of funds for the NED's work in Cuba. In fact, they doubled the amount of money being used to subvert the revolutionary Cuba in 2005. Now, what they're doing with the Foundation of the Americas, in fact, on the board of directors there, you have a former coup plotter in the form of Beatrice Rangel, who not only played an active role when she was an advisor to former Venezuelan President Perez in the late 80s, literally carrying bags of money, according to William Robinson, to Nicaraguan Contras operating out of Venezuela. But she's a person who, Rangel, who facilitated this NED program with this Canadian think tank. And she herself said that, you know, Canada enjoys this perception, and NED's outsourcing to Canada is just another way for the NED to penetrate Venezuelan civil society. But in the case of Haiti, getting back to that point, what we're seeing is the NED works very closely with the International Republican Institute. One of the NED's primary grantees in Haiti is a key member of the Group of 184 political opposition to Aristide named Hans Tippenauer. He heads up an organization that works with Haitian youth. Typically, we see the NED working with Haitian youth, with Haitian women. But what they're doing, Mr. Tippenauer, he was one of the first people to call the rebels, the paramilitaries that entered from the Dominican Republic in 2004. He referred to them as freedom fighters. And he gets grants from not only the NED, but also the IRI. And he also happens to be on the campaign of an independent presidential candidate named Charles Henry Baker, who was also one of the leaders of the Group 184. He's a sweatshop owner there and a brother-in-law of Andy Appeared, another leader of the Group 184, who recently has been pressuring with other members of the elite, such as Reginald Bulos, for the United Nations MINUSTAH force to enter the poor neighborhoods and commit more atrocities so as to enable this process of consolidating elite rule in Haiti to take root. And so Hans Tippenauer, as he doubles as a campaign manager for the Group 184 political candidate, the business candidate, basically a candidate that the U.S. is supporting, he's also working to penetrate Haitian civil society on a level that that will allow, in the long term, this neoliberal vision, this corporate vision of Haiti to take root, the so-called democracy. Because if the National Endowment for Democracy does promote some form of democracy, it's a very narrow institutional form, kind of like we see in Canada. It's ironic that we have elections going on here in Canada right now, but we don't see the National Endowment for Democracy or the International Republican Institute here trying to manipulate the political environment, because we're already on page with the State Department. We're already on page with the NED, so we don't need their guidance. But a place like Haiti, where there were where popular democracy was beginning to take root, even though in the face of a massive economic embargo and in the face of destabilization by these very organizations, that it's very necessary that, that these organizations are in Haiti right now playing this fundamental role behind the scenes, I should say, because the mainstream media has not written a single story about what these organizations are doing behind the scenes to affect political change in Haiti today.
Independent journalist Anthony Fenton will return with him in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to our interview on Haiti with independent journalist Anthony Fenton, co-author of the book Canada and Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. Anthony Fenton, one of the people that you have written and talked about is Ira Lowenthal. I remember him from, well, more than a decade ago, in the midst of the first coup against President Aristide in 1991 to 94, working for USAID in country in Haiti. What is his role today?
Well, after the coup, Ira Lowenthal re-entered Haiti. Now, he had to leave, I believe, in 2002 because he was getting too hot. He was up to some activities that were being scrutinized by the Haitian government. Now, he joined and helped create the Haiti Democracy Project in 2002, in late 2002, and then he supported the emergence of the Group 184 shortly thereafter, which is basically the Haitian version of the Haiti Democracy Project. I mentioned the Boulos family. Rudolph Boulos is a board member, founding board member of the Haiti Democracy Project as well. And he's actually running for Senate in the area of Haiti where they plan to develop free trade zones and open up a whole swath of sweatshops. But Ira Lowenthal, he was working for the America's Development Foundation, which was one of the key organizations implementing these so-called democracy enhancement projects prior to the coup. After the coup, he had a brief stint with them. And then he moved on to this other organization called the United Nations Office for Project Services. Now, it's a very interesting organization that does reconstruction work, and they're working, they're called the self-financing arm, management services arm of the United Nations. Very obscure and little known, but Ira Lowenthal became the director of this organization in Haiti just after the coup, and he helped set up registration centers for the elections, and he's played an integral role in the sort of infrastructure of carrying out this election process. Now, he stepped down as director of UN Ops, and UN Ops currently gets a $3 million contract from USAID to work and funnel money to the political parties, the approved, quote-unquote, approved political parties, most of which happen to be to comprise the former political opposition to Aristide, the Democratic Convergence. Now, Ira Lowenthal is a key consultant for UN Ops today, and in fact, there's a Canadian by the name of Jean-Francois Laurent who directs the UN Ops activities in Haiti. But Ira Lowenthal, anyone I speak to, everyone speaks glowingly of him in the democracy promotion community. He's an old hand there, as you said. He had links to the Boulos family back in the previous coup period. And, of course, the Boulos family is said to have had relations with FRAP, the paramilitary organization set up by the CIA in order to destroy the popular movement at that time. Now, the Boulos family, again, it's been widely reported that they may be linked, along with the APEDs, to death squad activity in Cité Soleil, anti-Lavalas gangs that are designed to destroy the popular support for the cause of demanding the return of Aristide or demanding the right to vote for the candidate of choice now, René Préval. But Ira Lowenthal has played an instrumental role. In fact, every week, this organization, UN Ops, to give you an example of the sort of familial relations there, They meet with the IRI, the NDI, with USAID, and with IFAS, which is the which is linked to the IRI. The chairman of IFAS is a former Reagan advisor and a Bush appointee as UN ambassador just before the 9/11 attacks in 2001, William Hybl. So you see this family meeting on a weekly basis, coordinating their activities. They're funneling millions of dollars to the political parties by way of giving them credits for TV advertising, for pamphlets, for T-shirts, and all sorts of other activities. And of course, this is all geared towards, they're hoping, I think, right now, that there will be a runoff election, sort of like there was in Liberia, where the International Republican Institute and these other organizations played a central role as well. Because if there's a runoff election, then it's possible that one of their right-wing candidates, perhaps such as Marc Bazin, who's running under the Lavalas name today, but of course was a World Bank candidate that Aristide beat in the landslide in 1990. They're hoping that one of these candidates, maybe it'll be Henry Baker, will be able to win in a runoff. But there's also the terror card that they're holding over their heads. The paramilitaries that entered in 2004, like Guy Philippe, other well-known narco-traffickers, the nephew of the current Prime Minister, Gerard Latortue, his name is Yuri Latortue. The mere mention of his name in Haiti strikes the fear into people's eyes when you speak to them. And this person is running for Senate in the Artibonite region. And the possibility of a violent intervention in this election process is in the background and it looms. And people like Ira Lowenthal and these other organizations, the NED, they're well aware of this. And so it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
In the role, Anthony Fenton, you're speaking to us from Vancouver, Canada, in the midst of your own elections of Canada and the current candidates in the coup of 2004, as well as what you understand as the U.S. role that forced Aristide out.
Well, indeed. Canada in September hosted a meeting with members of Haiti's private sector, with that think tank that I mentioned earlier that's getting NED funding, FOCAL, the Foundation for the Americas. Reginald Boulos, one of these the longtime elites who supported this U.S. vision for Haiti and has longstanding ties to Washington, he was invited to this meeting. And what you're seeing is Canada is supporting wholeheartedly. In fact, Roger Noriega, former ambassador, former Secretary of State for the Western Hemisphere, came to Canada just after the coup with Adolfo Franco from USAID. Franco, incidentally, has refused to be interviewed on the question of the USAID's activities on the democracy promotion side in Haiti recently. But they came to Canada just after the coup with the intention of asking Canada to play a leadership role in Haiti. And Canada quickly acquiesced. In fact, when I was in Haiti in September with a couple of other Canadian journalists, we interviewed a top-level Canadian diplomat, and he was boasting how finally in Haiti there's a government that's being ruled by the transnational elite and the private sector and civil society. And Canada's job is to stand on the front lines diplomatically, politically, and they're also helping out militarily and on the intelligence side to prop up this illegitimate regime that was installed by the United States, that was imported from Florida and installed imposed on the Haitian people. And so Canada is playing an increasing role, and they're expecting to play. In fact, this high-level diplomat told us Canada is sort of like earning its stripes in Haiti because there's going to be a coming transition, and he mentioned Cuba specifically. And of course, strategically, where Haiti is situated, the State Department in 2005 listed Haiti and Colombia as the two primary strategic states. So it's very important that they take control of Haiti. There's a Dominican Republic interest there as well. They're establishing military bases there. The U.S. has for a long time dictated the Dominican military's policies for the region. And the Canadian government here, what we're seeing is under the Liberal government that is about to, it appears, to lose power to a neoconservative electoral coup, if you will, led by Canada's Conservative Party and Stephen Harper, who is a well-known admirer of George Bush. Canada, the Liberal government, initiated a right-wing shift over the past decade that we've seen a new role for Canada in the Americas. In fact, this high-level diplomat referred to the destiny of Canada in the Americas being fulfilled through their role in Haiti today.
Anthony Fenton is our guest. He's speaking to us from Vancouver, Canada. And the proof of the involvement of the U.S. government in the coup that forced out President Aristide, February 29, 2004.
Well, in 2003, there was a meeting held in Ottawa called the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti. At the time, it was a secret high-level roundtable that did not involve any Haitians, although it was a meeting that was designed to discuss the future of Haiti. It was leaked by the host of that meeting, a Canadian member of parliament named Denis Paradis, to a Quebec magazine that the possibility of removing Aristide and installing a UN-style trusteeship was discussed. This was quickly glossed over, and the Canadian government retracted that this was discussed. But after the coup, I submitted a Freedom of Information Act request and did receive some of the documents which seemed to corroborate what was leaked at the time, and that there were high-level meetings being held not only in Ottawa, but other follow-up meetings, I understand, in Washington and in El Salvador, that planned the overthrow of Aristide on the diplomatic side. The Organization of American States was involved. Then Assistant Secretary General of the OAS, Luigi Einaudi, who famously said on the eve of Haiti's independence, the problem with Haiti is that the international community is so screwed up and divided that we're actually allowing Haitians to run Haiti. Well, it was people like this and sentiments like this that informed these sorts of meetings that took place before the coup. And, you know, the writing was on the wall for Aristide when he was elected in November of 2000. You know, we saw the opposition boycott the elections. Gallup polls indicated a landslide victory for Aristide. And again, we return to the point made by the NED program officer. It was simply the case that from the perspective of the United States, Canada, and France, and the European Union, the primary backers of this coup d'etat, that Aristide was consolidating power, that the Lavalas party in particular, and that the popular movement was emerging and was taking root, and that is what had to be overthrown and stopped in its tracks, and that's what we're seeing happen today.
Very quickly, Anthony Fenton, on the issue of what's happening in Cité Soleil with the killings of innocent residents there, also the killings of UN forces there. Recently, you had Reginald Bulos and Andy Appaid, well-known anti-Lavalas leaders, holding a major protest calling for a crackdown on Cité Soleil. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, again, you know, this, I read that as a provocation. They've been, if you go back to summer of 2005, there was a kidnapping spree, as the New York Times and the LA Times reported it, that was used as a pretext to demand that the UN go into Cité Soleil and root out the so-called chimeras, the so-called bandits, the so-called terrorists. Now, I learned through sources inside the Prime Minister's office in Haiti and through other sources that, again, Yuri Latortue, the nephew of Gerard Latortue, was involved in this kidnapping spree, that he was carrying out and overseeing a kidnapping ring of his own that was used as a pretext to go into these neighborhoods and commit massacres. And on July 6th, it's been well reported and well documented that a massacre did take place, and it was carried out by the United Nations. It buckled to the pressure that was being exerted on it by the likes of Reginald Bulos and other members of the elite like Andy Appaid. And so I think, from what I can tell, this is being replayed. And the kidnapping spree, it's possible that these assaults on the peace, so-called peacekeepers, the Jordanians, who have played one of the more repressive roles in Cité Soleil, that is another provocation that is intended to pressure the UN forces to go into Cité Soleil and fire arbitrarily, as they've been doing repeatedly. You know, within the past few days, a number of people have been killed in Cité Soleil, even since that demonstration. Canadian journalists who are there right now, Aaron Lakoff and Leslie Bagg, reported on how four people in Cité Soleil have been killed. And the UN knows that they can't go into Cité Soleil and conduct these operations without killing civilians. And yet, people like Reginald Bulos don't seem to mind if civilians get killed. It's just collateral damage, and he said that, you know, he's willing to create a fund to assist the victims of Cité Soleil. When we interviewed Mr. Bulos in September, he referred to himself as Mr. Cité Soleil. So he has a vested interest in putting down this this popular movement that's calling for Aristide's return or calling for free and fair elections that would see René Préval win in a likely landslide.
Independent journalist Anthony Fenton, co-author of the book Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. Haitian elections are February 7th. Canadian elections are today. And that does it for today's broadcast. Look forward to seeing people on Friday night in Oakland, California, with Alice Walker on Saturday night, Humboldt State University, also in California. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shroof Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Our website is democracynow.org. There you can get our video and audio podcast and transcript. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.